I continue to daven even when it's challenging, in the hope that I will find a path. And even if I don't find a path at the moment, I continue to come to daven, not just for my community, it's because I hope that I will connect. And the truth is, there are times that I connect.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.
Okay. My name is Zvi Hirschfield, and we are about to record my own personal first live This Pardes Life session. So, yeah, you can make some noise. There are 300 people here tonight, which is really very, very exciting. I am thrilled because what a privilege and a pleasure to introduce my friend, colleague, teacher, mentor, the Maggid of Melbourne himself, Rabbi Dr. Levi Cooper, who, I want to tell you, you can't imagine all the accomplishments of this very young man's life. He is a lawyer. He is a scholar and academic. He is a shul rabbi. He is a Torah teacher. He is an Australian football star. He is an excellent tour guide, experiential educator, food critic, whiskey expert. I could go on and on. But as you guys may have listened, if you have not listened to this series, shame on you, and download it from the Elmad site. But it's my privilege to do a little chavruta with different Pardes teachers and others. And I've asked Levi to pick a text that's special to him. We're going to learn it together, and it's going to be a chance to ask him some questions and have a good conversation. So thank you very much for being here, Levi Cooper.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, Zvi. I also think that it's a great opportunity. I'm so glad that we're studying together here in Pardes's new workspace, WeWork. I think this is the inaugural shiur in Pardes's new workspace here in New York. I don't come here very often, so I'm very glad that we're taking this opportunity to sanctify this already holy place. So I'm glad to be learning together with you.
And I want to thank Meira and Liana and everybody else from the Pardes team who helped put this together. Very, very much appreciated. Okay. Did the text make it around the room? Terrific. So I think we'll begin by giving you all a chance to do a little bit of learning b'chavruta, and then we'll come back and do some learning all together.
But before we do this word learning for chavruta, let me give a few words of introduction about the text. Zvi asked me a few days ago, he said, we're going to be learning together. Can you choose a text that has some meaning for me, a text that speaks to me and that reflects some of the challenges or some of my my spiritual growth, my spiritual journey? And the text that you have in front of you is a text that appears at the end of the first ever published Hasidic work. The first ever published Hasidic work, which is known as Toldot Yaakov Yosef. It was published in Koretz in the year Tof Kuf Mem, 1780. And this work, at the back of this work, the work at the moment, by the way, is a fantastic work. It documents things that the Baal Shem Tov told his student, Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy. And if you own a first edition, the first edition's worth quite a hefty sum. I'm just mentioning it because my birthday's coming up, in case. At the end of this work, as an appendix, the author, Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polnoy, has a list of things that he lists as Dvarim Sheshamati Mimori, things I heard from my master. And there are various statements, Torot, teachings from the Baal Shem Tov. So this is really the first recorded teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. And a very important text because it's the first time the world gets, not the people who actually interact with the Baal Shem Tov, but once a work is published, so more people have access to it. And I've chosen a passage from that appendix, Dvarim Sheshamati Mimori, and that's the text in front of you. Because we're at a Pardes event, rather than just reading the text before you, we'll start off by having a bit of chavruta learning. You've all got the text in front of you. So if you can pair up or triple up and study the text. And then after that, after we stop, we'll have a look and we'll highlight some of what I believe are the main themes of this passage. I saw the text many years ago, but this is the first time I actually taught it. So for me, this is, in a sense, a new text that I'm sharing with people. So I'm very happy to have that opportunity to look at it together with you again.
Okay, so I realize those listening on their computer did not benefit from the insights that our students brought, but will hopefully raise some of the things and the ideas that they commented on. So, Levi, it's a long text, and we don't have time to go through all of it, but maybe you can walk us through some passages that are particularly meaningful to you.
Thank you, Tzvi. I would start by just giving a word of background. The text quotes Rav Nachman of Horodenka, who explains something from the Baal Shem Tov. So Rav Nachman of Horodenka, just to give us the historical context, he leaves Europe and he goes to the land of Israel in 1740. And then he has a dream, which is described in this text, and maybe we'll get to that dream. He has a dream that there is a potion, an elixir, there's a medicine that's better, a spiritual potion that is better than what he has at that moment. And because of that dream, he returns to Europe where he studies with the Baal Shem Tov. And then when the Baal Shem Tov passes away in 1760, Rav Nachman of Horodenka moves back to the land of Israel in 1764, and he dies a year later in 1765. And for me, it's a particularly close text because Rav Nachman of Horodenka is buried to this very day in the old cemetery of Tveria, right next to my great-great-few-greats grandfather, who came to the land of Israel in the Aliyah of the Hasidim who came to Israel in the year Taklaz, 1777. So it's an Aliyah that's after Rav Nachman of Horodenka, but it's that Hasidic community, those Hasidim who came to the land of Israel very early on, and they're both buried in the old cemetery of Tveria. So that's a little bit of a personal connection that I have with this text.
Amazing.
That's one of the reasons I chose the text. I also chose the text because, even though it's a short text, it seems to me that it carries a lot of the very central ideas of Hasidut. And one of them is right at the beginning, where he says that in every verbal expression, a person should go through three stages, which he describes as Hachna'a, Havdala, and Hamtaka. So let's translate those three terms. Hachna'a, we could translate as submission, a person humbling themselves. Havdala, separation, taking a step back. And Hamtaka is sweetening. The idea here, which Rav Nachman of Horodenka is attributing to the Baal Shem Tov, is that a person's spiritual growth, for real spiritual growth, needs to go through those three stages. You can't automatically have hamtaka. Things don't work that way. Suddenly you have everything sweet. There needs to be a bit of a process. There needs to be growth. And the growth over here, the process that's described over here, is one where we start off with, first of all, I need to put myself aside. Submission. Humility. And after I've done that, taking a step back from the mire, the quagmire that I'm in, that I'm stuck in, and then there can be hamtaka, there can be growth, there can be sweetening.
So, I have a couple questions for you.
Oy
vey. I'm going to interrupt your beautiful shiur to make you answer my questions because I'm a curious person. This is my chance because you can't run away. So he says here, shichavein b'chol dibor, a person should intend in every verbal expression. So my question is, first of all, who is he speaking with that people are going to be this deliberate all the time? And I want to know if you, Levi Cooper, attempt in your own life to be this deliberate in your both communications with other people. Have you ever attempted this?
So I think you're asking two very different questions. You're asking an historical question. Who is he talking to?
Or even theoretical. Does he see this as a program that people are, that the average person out there is actually going to take on?
The early Hasidim were not talking to the average person. In this time, in the 18th century, they were a coterie of elites, really. Hasidism as a much more popular movement takes hold only in the 19th century. So in this stage, he's talking to people who want to be spiritually mindful. Having said that, I think the text has a timeless element to it. And it's not just talking to a few spiritual elites. It is trying to say something to anybody who is interested in spiritual growth. But I actually think your second question is a much more challenging question, the personal question you're asking me. Am I this mindful? I don't know if anybody's interested really in that question.
Oh, I think we're interested.
But since you asked it, and I'm happy to relate to the question, the answer to the question for me is, look, I'm a regular person. And as a regular person, I can't live my life at high spiritual tension at every single moment. Having said that, this text is a text that certainly I have in my pocket, so that I try and I strive as much as possible, certainly at moments of spiritual growth, when there are spiritual challenges, at times when I want to move beyond where I am at that time. So this is a text that anchors me, and that serves as a framework for me to use.
Okay. Terrific.
Okay,
I'm inspired.
Just trying to answer the question.
Yes.
The second aspect of this passage that piqued my interest was in the second paragraph, where he says that a person has to try to judge everybody favorably. Okay, we're familiar with that adage. That's not a chidush, that's not an innovation of Hasidut. But in this passage, he says something different. Says Rav Nachman of Horodenka, explaining the Baal Shem Tov, that when a person sees something in another person that is negative, he uses a very strong term, ugliness. When a person sees something that's spiritually distasteful, a person should see that, and rather than saying, oh, that person, oh, what a dreck, what a lowlife, a person should see that person and say, you know what? The reason I can see that is because there's something inside of me that I need to improve. I've only seen that because I have an element of that inside of me. I find this to be extremely relevant, particularly in davening. I find davening very challenging. And in davening, you know, I could be davening in my shul in Tzur Hadassah, and there can be a person who's sitting a few seats away from me and finishes before me, and I'm not a particularly long davener, but that person finished before me, and they start talking. I'm like, Rabbeinu Shalom, what are you talking? I'm still trying to daven. And my first reaction is, like, come on, you're sitting a few seats away from the rabbi. You know, come on, man.
And a famous rabbi to boot.
Any rabbi,
okay.
In shul, other people are trying to daven. What are you talking? So you finished early. And that is my first reaction, one of frustration. And this passage says to me, steady on, mate. If you're noticing, if you're hearing that person talking, that says something, not so much about that person, says something about your own prayer. And maybe I'm not really concentrating so well if I can hear that person disturbing me. And if I was really concentrating, then I'd be able to block that person out. So this passage actually is something that I... This second message is something that I think about very often and take with me and find very challenging.
So I guess I want to react and see what you think about that. A couple of things here I would find very, very difficult for myself personally. Number one, there's like an invitation here to be constantly self-critical. It might be because I get angry and annoyed way too often. But I'm saying there is a sense of this being in this constant state of feeling not good enough that scares me a little bit. I'm wondering, like, how I would carry that. And this other piece that every difficult situation thrown my way is for my own good. And there's a sense of I have to be grateful for everything. And I'm wondering, is there any room for me just to be angry and frustrated? In either direction, angry and frustrated with another person, as opposed to just myself, and maybe a little angry and frustrated with God that these curveballs are coming my way. I'm wondering if that sense of it has ever occurred to you.
One of the great things to be in our tradition generally, and the Chassidut just continues this, is that our tradition is multivocal, and we hear different voices at the same time. The Mishnah, this great codification, has alternate opinions. Now, as someone with legal training, you look at the Mishnah and you say, that's not a code. It's got one opinion, and then it's got another opinion, and then it's got a moral adage in the middle. And that's one of the great things about our tradition, that it does have different voices that are speaking at the same time. And I would say, also in Chassidus, that following that tradition, this isn't the only passage in Chassidus. And we have... the person I'm named after, Rav Levi Yitzchok of Berditchev. Rav Levi Yitzchok of Berditchev, one of the things he's famous for is turning to God and saying, that's not good enough, and arguing with God very vociferously. So that also exists. Having said that, this passage I find doesn't make me into a person who's overly self-critical, but it does help me not focus on another person's shortcomings, rather focusing on how I can grow spiritually and Jewishly in my own life. And for me, that's very helpful, because it's very easy for me to fall into a trap of seeing the other and saying, that person's not good enough, or that person should be doing this or that, whether it's because I'm a teacher or a rabbi of a community or a parent. And this passage says, you know, that shouldn't be your focus. See those things and try to grow from them rather than look at them in a negative way.
I think it's not only not negative, but thank you, God, for sending me this person talking 8 inches away from me when I'm trying to daven, because that's your message for me that I need to work on my davening.
Yeah. So maybe I'm not at the level that I'm really saying thank you, God, for the person who's disturbing my tefillah. But I think as far as my own spiritual journey, I'm certainly at the level where I'm saying, steady on, slow down. How can I turn this into a learning moment for myself? And you know what? Why aren't I focusing enough? I need to rethink about my own tefillah. And that's one example. I'm sure there are many examples that you guys sitting here can translate it into something that is meaningful for yourselves. I'm just sharing with you that tefillah is where I've encountered it.
Okay. Are we ready to continue? I think we should read the passage inside that you want to focus on next.
Okay, let's have a look at the third point that I wanted to share with you. The line starts off, I'm going to point it in Hebrew, and it starts off, V'ha'ikar. V'ha'ikar. Lahavin Shahashem Yitbarach. The main point is to understand that God, Bechol Makom Uvechol Asakav, God is in every place and in every aspect of a person's dealings. Imken, and this is the line that really catches my eye, so make a note of it on your source sheets, underline it. Imken. If so, גם בסיפורי דברים יוכל להרגיש ענייני הבורא יתברך. Even in סיפורי דברים we could translate as stories, storytelling, regular conversation, a person can sense divine matter. כמו בלימודו ותפילתו, just like when a person studying Torah and when a person's praying. And this passage speaks to me, because if I had to summarize one of the main messages of Chassidut. I would suggest, I don't have to, but if I did.
If you did.
If I did, then I would suggest that one of the main messages of Chassidut is that there are multiple paths to fulfilling our destiny, to bringing godliness into this world. Classically, the classic ways of bringing God into this world were prayer and study of Torah. Comes along Chassidut and says, yeah, prayer and study of Torah, they're valid, they're great paths, but they're not the only paths. And there are other paths as well. This passage mentions storytelling. I'm a storyteller and I love stories. Those of you who have studied with me, you know my classes are filled with stories. That in this passage he says telling a story can also be a spiritual practice. And he's really opening up a small the corner of a curtain that if we, as we remove the entire curtain, we suddenly realize that there's a whole gamut of ways of serving God. Not just, obviously, prayer. Obviously, studying Torah. And now we know also telling stories. But what we also know from the story of Chassidut, that could be dancing. That could be singing. That could be good deeds. There are so many ways. And for me, that says that the challenge is that I need to find what is my path, how can I excel in bringing godliness into this world. So, I love music. But you know, I wasn't endowed with such a beautiful voice. Dancing's not my thing.
You're very light on your feet, I disagree.
I am, particularly when I tap dance. I don't know of any other Hasidic masters who tap danced. Other.
We'll have to emphasize on the word other.
So that might not be my path. But I can recognize that there are other people who that is their path. And this passage opens up the options and says to me, there are many ways of serving God.
So I have to jump in. I felt a vision of Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal and Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal staring at me, giving me a look, a very dark, angry look. I think, how wide does this go? In other words, we're Torah teachers. We're out there, and there's some people in the back here who spend a lot of their time telling people that without Torah, you're going to be missing something. Your ability to find your fullest Jewish expression is going to be lacking something. They might say it in stronger terms, I don't know, without Torah study. I'm just wondering for yourself, how wide does this go? And is there really godliness in everything? Are there any lines where we'd say, you know what, there's no godliness in that. I don't find godliness there. And is there a base, a frame of Torah and Tefillah that is still necessary, no matter how much music and dancing and clapping and drinking the l'chaim. I got a little cynical at the end, I apologize.
Yes.
But I'm just sort of wondering what your take is on that. As someone who spends a lot of time in deep scholarly pursuit.
Yeah, so first of all, you mentioned Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and certainly I'm not coming to argue with those greats of our generation. Afar ani tachat kapot raglehem, I'm but dust under their soles of their feet. I'm just trying to understand.
That's usually the preface before people disagree sharply with other rabbis. Please continue.
I think you're raising a good point. I am suggesting here that there is a very wide gamut, a very wide spectrum of options. Having said that, the flip side is that we also need to create Jewish community. And for Jewish community, we need to engage in pursuits that bring us together. And if every one of us is only doing where I find my spiritual expression, then we're really on our own. I think that's one of the great critiques of Martin Buber's vision of religion. You know, Martin Buber would say, you know, not religion, religion's terrible, but a religious person finds their own spiritual experience. And the response that I would say to Martin Buber is, fantastic, you've got each person being very religious, but you don't have any community. So I would suggest that we as a community need to engage in common pursuits to at least a minimal level. And then within the communal structures, we need to find, we need to acknowledge how each person can find their own path within those communal structures. So it might be that a certain person says, you know what, davening doesn't really do it for me. My response to that person is, okay, fine, don't go to davening. No, I'm not saying that. No, you have to go to davening. You have to go to davening. You know why you have to go to davening? Because you need to go to davening because there's someone else in your community who, for davening, davening is it. And you need to facilitate the davening of that person because davening happens in a community.
It's only community? Now, I want to push you on this
point. Go ahead.
You really want to suggest that there's not a unique spiritual intellectual wisdom in Torah study that's irreplaceable. No matter how moved I am by poetry, Shakespeare, Dante, you name it, and Bab Metzia doesn't do it for me. Would you, Levi Cooper, still stand up and say, as much as your heart is moved by the classics of Western literature, we still, you personally, forget the community for a minute, even for your own personal spiritual path, you still need Torah and you still need Tefillah, whether you can see it right now or not?
I think it's interesting to me that I kept giving examples of Tefillah because I'm personally challenged by Tefillah, and you keep bringing it back to Torah, where, and you've made it easy for me. You've made it easy for me because I happen to personally believe that the Jewish renaissance of our generation is dependent on engagement with text. And therefore, if you're asking me, I think that everybody has to engage in texts, has to learn Torah. And if we're not learning Torah, then we won't be connected. So you've made it easy for me.
So we'll go with
I'm not
tefillah.
Giving you another opportunity.
All right, so we'll go with tefillah. The person says, you know, it's when I listen to Mozart, that's when my soul climbs to heaven. And when I go to synagogue or even pray alone, the words don't speak to me, the language doesn't speak to me, the concepts don't speak to me. It's a dry exercise. So they come to you, the Maggid of Melbourne, and they say, Rabbi Cooper, should I really take the time to say all these words that, and let's say I'm traveling. There's no community for me to join. I'm not going to let you play the community card. Should I really say these words, or should I turn on the music and let my soul have its moment?
I think you're asking me a very challenging question.
Well, finally, we got that.
That I don't have a good answer to. I don't have a good answer to that because, you know, it's very hard in our generation to say to an autonomous person who says, I don't see any personal value, and for me to say, yes, there's value in something that I can't see that is tangible. Do I believe that there's value in the tefillah? I do. But it's very hard for me to suggest to another person, you have to still daven. What I've said to people when I've been faced with that question is, first of all, I've identified with them, because as I've said to you, I find davening challenging. And then I've said to them that I continue to daven even when it's challenging in the hope that I will find a path. And even if I don't find a path at the moment, I continue to be involved in tefillah. I continue to come to davening, not just for my community and because I think it's important to be part of a community. It's because I hope that I will connect. And the truth is there are times that I connect. It's not a totally dry experience. There are times. And so there is a hope. For me, though, tefillah is one thing. It's very community oriented. Torah study, for me, is the key to Jewish life in our generation.
Okay, so we'll leave a little bit of the Tzarech Iyun there. There's more work to be done to think about. Let's take up one more point.
One more. I have two more that I wanted to touch on, so I'll do them briefly.
That's a classic rabbinic move, to disagree but sound like you're agreeing at the same time. Go ahead.
In the next line, The passage says that the matter of na'aseh v'nishma, and this directly connects to your previous question, Tzvi. Na'aseh v'nishma, which is the classic statement where the Jewish people say, we will do and then we will understand and then we will learn. The passage says, shehu b'chol adam u'v'chol zman. It's not just a historical moment. It is also something that is that happens for every person and at every juncture, at every time. So I think that connects to what you were saying, that sometimes tefillah, even if you don't connect, na'aseh v'nishma, the challenge of doing, and with the hope that afterwards we will understand, I think that fits into this passage over here.
There's a real critique, really, I think, of the standard Kabbalistic model of trying to do all these meditations and get yourself into a place where when you utter the words, you're already on this very exalted level. And here he seems to be saying, doesn't need to work that way all the time. Sometimes you have to jump in and do, and the inspiration will come later.
Yes, yes. But since you've only given me one more point, that I'm not going to dwell on that. And I'm going to move to my last point in this passage that I wanted to share with you. It's the line beginning, V'ha'ikar lahasir ha'atzvut v'le'echoz b'simcha. The principle or the main challenge is to remove sadness and grasp simcha, hold on to happiness, joy. And one of the themes of Chassidut is to live a joyful life. I think it's interesting that it's in this passage, it's not something that you do once and then you're finished. La'asir ha'atzvut, remove sadness, le'echoz, grasp onto simcha. A person who is happy the whole time, that's not real happiness. Happiness is only an emotion that we feel in contrast to sadness. And yet Chassidus says that we need, as a person, an individual should try to, on the balance, be a person who is a happier person. Should try, on the balance, to be a person who can move aside the sadness, not wallow in sadness. Because spiritual growth, construction, building ourselves, building our communities, contributing to society, doesn't happen when we are stuck in the mud. It happens when we feel free of spirit, when we come with joy. And I think that's another one of the central themes of Chassidus, that it has an expression here in this short passage.
So I have a couple follow-up to that one sentence. First of all, this is something I have a very hard time with. I have a hard time pushing aside sadness and grabbing happiness. So I'm wondering, first of all, if you see yourself as a very naturally joyous person, or do you think this is something you personally have to work at? And I guess my other question is, it almost feels like this sentence is stuck in here. I didn't feel like he was talking about it yet. And then he just suddenly takes this turn, and the main thing is, I'm just wondering if you could comment on that, on why here and now in the text, and then maybe relate personally to this teaching.
So first, why is it here in the text? Because I think he says it after he says about na'aseh v'nishma, that we'll do, and then we will understand. It can be very depressing to be stuck in doing things that you don't really understand. And it's challenging. And I think he's balancing that and saying, look, I know it's challenging. We somehow have to lift ourselves up and be joyful. As far as the personal question you asked me, I don't think that naturally I'm a person who's always happy. But I certainly have taken this as a challenge. When I'm sad, I do try to lift myself up. I do try to find a way to make myself into more of a positive person. As with any person, when I'm challenged with things, I don't always succeed. But certainly this is something that guides my life. This is one of the reasons why I would define myself as a chosid, because this is something, these things that I've shared with you this evening, are part of my regular spiritual practices.
Can you just say one sentence about what that would look like as a regular spiritual practice?
What would it look like?
Engaging these ideas as a regular spiritual practice. I'm not talking about Bekesh's and Gartel's and this. I'm talking more about What are the reminders that you use day to day to sort of re-engage these ideas?
I don't think I use reminders. I think that that these are ideas that are inside of me, and when I catch myself in a very sad position, I try to find a way to lift my spirits. And I imagine every person has mechanisms that they have for themselves that can raise their spirits. For me, it might be having a l'chaim, it might be doing exercise, it might be learning a text that brings me joy, or reading a book that I find inspiring. So I don't think I have reminders, but it is part of who I am. The idea of recognizing multiple paths in the service of God. I don't have reminders. This is part of who I am.
On that note, first I want to say what a privilege it's been to learn with you. It's worth doing podcasts just to force you into having a chavruta with me. You are a very interesting and complex chassid, I have to tell you, and a fascinating one. There's a lot more here. We could do 10 more podcasts with you and with this text, but we're not. We're going to pause now. I want to thank everybody who's been listening for listening, and I hope you continue listening. And thank you again, Lady Cooper, for your time, your wisdom, and your energy. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Zvi. Thank you.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.